Blog Talk Radio.
Host Merle Exit. Yep, let's see, it's 6 o'clock on my time here in New York City. It's a really cloudy day. Well, it just happened where I am in Queens. It didn't seem to rain. I mean, I was hearing people talking to people today where it was like pouring and stuff like that, and the big news in New York City is Justin Bieber got knocked down. Somebody jumped over some fence and knocked him to the ground. So that's the big news. So that's, let's see, that'll probably be bigger news than whether same-sex marriage is going to come to a vote. But, you know, because Justin Bieber, yeah. But anyway, so today's show, well, we're going to continue with California. It's a show, I think everything that we'll be talking about is in Yolo County. I stayed in the town of Davis at the Hallmark Inn, absolutely wonderful hotel, wonderful location. I'll have them on the show at some point. But what we're doing today, I think this is all food. No, it's somewhat food related, okay. Because they got some, we've got farm too. I'll tell you. We're going to be starting with when I dined at Monticello Bistro, as opposed to Monticello Bistro. And their menu they use local products. So we're going to talk about, you know, what comes from the farms there. And then it'll be time to pick some of the products, because we're going off to Impossible Acres, where I mostly picked berries. We're going to say how that works, what they have, what's going on there. And then to the Hague Farm for walnuts. Yeah, we're going to talk about their nuts. Then the last is the Heidrick Agricultural History Center. A whole bunch of old farm tools, and they have a budding truck museum. So what I'm going to do now is, actually waiting for the caller, I am going to... You know what it's time for right now.
What would you do to earn brownie points? How about treating someone to what may be the best brownies they've ever tasted? Fairy Tale Brownies. They may seem like one of the richest bars of fudge, with varieties that include caramel, chocolate chip, espresso nib, raspberry swirl, mint chocolate, all made with Calbo dark Belgian chocolate. But yes, they are brownies, and that's no fairy tale.
Yes, and you can get, of course, these wonderful, wonderful brownies, I know. Well, it's the summertime now. I don't know if they'll deliver them to me or if I want them delivered to me. You can get them at www.brownies.com. I don't know what's happening. It's, what is 3 o'clock on their time? Well, let's just, I'm going to make an attempt. I'm going to call their phone number and we'll see what happens. Okay. Yes.
Monticello, this is Rhonda.
Rhonda, this is Merle Exit calling.
Hey, Merle, I am just trying to find your number. And my computer is not, it's driving me, there it goes. I was just going to call you.
Oh, my
goodness,
you know what? Yeah, but you know what?
What?
You're on the air now.
Oh, all right. Hi, everybody. Hi, Merle. I really was going to call you. I was just like, of course, I come in here and the computer's not booted up and it's like taking forever and then my password wouldn't load automatically like it's supposed to.
Well, fortunately, I paid a price. I mean, it's not really expensive, but this Blog Talk Radio, what if you pay like a little extra kind of thing, you can dial out. So when that comes up, I go, okay, just in case someone forgot, so I'll dial. And once
very
I dial,
nice.
And although it has a thing, it says like screen, meaning I guess I could dial and let's say have a conversation with you while not being on the air. I don't know how to use it yet. So however it is, when they call, they're on the air.
You'll have to save the screen function for when you like talk to Donald Trump or something.
Oh yeah. Mhm. Sure. So anyway, what I want to talk about with you is one of the restaurants that I had gone to that's where they deal with local fare. So I understand like you're first of all, you know, say where you are, blah blah blah, blah, and then we'll get you're in Davis, right?
I am in Davis, California, home to the Aggies and UC Davis, University of Davis, which many people from New York and, you know, all over come to go to school and sometimes stay, sometimes go back. But I am located at 630 G Street, which is next to the Davis Food Co-op. We're kind of a mid-sized town. I think we have about, 75,000 people. A lot of them are students. And we're in Yolo County, which is home to beautiful agriculture. We have wonderful agriculture here. And a lot of our local farms source food to the Bay Area to restaurants such as Chez Panisse and Zuni Cafe and Oliveto and all of these wonderful places in the Bay Area that serve local seasonal food. So we thought, gosh, shouldn't we have some restaurant like that here in Davis where we live? So there you have it. That's us, Monticello Seasonal Cuisine.
So how long have you guys been open?
We opened this restaurant in Davis in, it was an interesting date. It was 01-11. So it was January 11th, or January 11th, 2011. So we thought that might be lucky. I mean, it wasn't planned that way. It was all because of the fire marshal not signing off on our mural because he thought no one could see the door. But it ended up being, I think, a lucky day. So we hope.
Well, did I catch something as I was trying to get some information? Did you move, or was there another location or something?
Yes, we actually had a place in Winters. We had a trial restaurant where we tried out our concept, both to try out our concept and to find out if we were really crazy enough to do this business. We had a little restaurant in Winters, which is also in Yolo County, and that's actually where a lot of our produce comes from as well. Cape Valley, we have a lot of farmers who live in Winters. And we were there from 2006 to 2008. And we did a prefix style menu the first year, kind of like Chez Panisse does. It's kind of like whatever was available from the farmers was what you were going to have for dinner. And then the following year, we continued with the prefix, but we also broke out and did an a la carte for people who didn't want that much food or wanted some other options. And we loved it. We absolutely loved it. We had a nice following from Davis, which is where we live. We had, you know, wonderful friends in Winters. And the plan was, if we liked it, to go ahead and bite the bullet and try and find a place in Davis. And it took us, you know, gosh, another 2 years, almost 3 years, to find a place that worked for our budget, that was a good location for us. Davis is, you know, commercial property here can be expensive because it's a university town.
Ah.
But we lucked out. We got a great place next to the Davis Food Co-op, and those are, of course, our good friends. And my husband, Tony, is the chef, and, you know, he's been writing a food column for the Davis Food Co-op for many years, so, of course, the co-op was very excited as well. So, yeah, we're happy here.
Wow, I can imagine. So, actually, what had gone on, what I want you to know is that when I was coming there, like, because Yolo County was there, what are you asking? What I wanted? What kind of restaurants? And I said that I was interested in going to the restaurants that had local, that used local stuff, because, you know, with seeing the list of all the farms and things like that, I said, well, you know, that's what I'm interested in, you know, and not, of course, and nothing that's a chain, you know, et cetera, et cetera. So when I saw you on the list and I kind of looked at the menu and I went, here's one of the places I want to go. Hope that can
Well, we were thrilled to have you. And, of course, I will always remember that you were very interested in cherries.
Oh, yes. And I got a little story to tell you about that. But I'll tell you, like, right afterwards about the thing with cherries. But what I want to get to first, I was interested in cherries because, you know, when cherry season comes out, it's always been my favorite fruit. So when cherry season comes out, and I'm someplace already, I mean, I guess, and the thing is, I really haven't looked to see if what's growing out on Long Island, because if you go out to Long Island in, I guess, Suffolk County is where all the farms are, it's not like, you know, I can't, you know, get somebody to get me in the car and drive out there. But it's just the knowing already, especially with California, of things that are growing there and things that maybe be growing there that are not growing out on Long Island. So that was one of the reasons. But what I do want to do get to is, I hope you remember what I ate. I remember some of the things, and I'm sure, like, I took photos. I'm glad I take photos of things. So I could say, oh, what was that? Oh, yeah. It's funny because what's standing out, there's two particular things that I remember eating. And one was the vegetarian sandwich with bacon added to it.
Yes.
I remembered that. And I also remembered the chocolate pot au feu. What is it?
The pot de crème.
Yeah, pot au crème, something with, I knew it was something,
yes,
with pot. That. So those are the two things offhand. Now, so perhaps we can go to, let's talk about your menu. What is kind of on the menu? What you got specials for today?
Well, today we had a frittata, and the frittata had artichokes and English peas. And it was actually what I had for lunch. And that frittata is paired with a salad made of kind of chicory, bitter greens, arugula and radicchio and some frisée, and a side of some roasted potatoes. And you probably had some of the roasted potatoes accompanying one of your... Did you have the pulled pork sandwich as well?
Yes. That's
okay.
True. Yes, I did. Yes,
yeah.
I did
yeah.
have potatoes. Yes, 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 yes.
Yeah, we...
Now I remember.
Tony
I'll
is,
see a photo. Yeah.
Yeah, Tony is both German and Polish, so he gets the potato, you know, gene from both sides. So there are potatoes sometimes also in our pasta, which, of course, our friends who are Italian, they also are like, oh my gosh, I can't pass up pasta when there's some potatoes in there too. But yes, and the pulled pork you ate, actually, we not only source our produce from local farmers, we also source a lot of our meat from local farmers, and that pork comes from a gentleman named John Bledsoe, and John raises Duroc pigs. They're kind of a brown, hairy, you know, heirloom variety pig, and oh my goodness, they just make a really good, you know, pork anything. So you had some of John Bledsoe's pulled pork, and we do it North Carolina style. Of course, you know, we were fortunate enough to have somebody from North Carolina try it out and tell us we got it right, because, you know, Tony, being an upstate New Yorker who was transplanted here to California, and me being pretty much a California girl, you know, we needed expert advice and opinions as to whether we got it right, because we wouldn't have known otherwise.
Now, when you in terms of the pork, you're getting it, it's already, is already prepared that you get from him? Is he doing this, or he's sending you the...
Yeah, he has it butchered and gives us... No, we actually cook it ourselves, of course.
Oh, okay.
But, you know, he has it butchered for us. And actually, recently, we did a party for a couple. They rented out the whole restaurant. They had gotten married in Hawaii, and they were having their reception here where all their friends were and their family. And John brought us a whole pig, so we did a big pig roast. But, no, Tony does a, for North Carolina-style pulled pork, you do a dry rub overnight, and then you just cook it and cook it and cook it, and you do a honey vinegar mustard sauce with it. So it's a very succulent, you know, tasty sandwich, and people really like that.
Yes, that was good. And I guess, like, even the potatoes the reason why I'm asking, let's say, are the potatoes local is, like, because sometimes I wonder, well, you know, there are certain things that are in season and not in season. I don't even know when things grow. The only thing I always remember, like, tomatoes or cherries in June. That's all I seem to remember. But I don't know if that's
that. Your timing was perfect for cherries. You were just right on. I mean, the cherries, because we've had some odd weather, so it's been difficult to determine even the normal seasons for things. You know, when you came, it was still relatively cool. But the cherries had just, you know, but prior to that, we were having hail and rain and, you know, it was not looking
and
good.
And locusts. And all these other things.
Yeah, exactly. our farmer partner, Jim, who owns Fiddler's Green Farm, he says the planet is having fever and chills. So that's what he says, fever and chills. You know, you just never know what's going to happen. It's definitely precarious. I mean, being a farmer is precarious enough, but when you've got, you know, odd weather patterns happening... whether you believe in global warming or not, there certainly are odd weather patterns happening all over the world right now.
Yeah.
You know, we certainly, and I think most farmers pretty much believe in global warming, particularly small organic farmers. But anyway, yeah, it's precarious, but we were very pleased to have cherries on hand for your visit.
Oh, I'm so glad, and I made sure that I slowly munched on them as well. So let's get back into the menu. Let's see. That's right. There was Did we try a soup?
You did. And our soup changes every day. I think you may have had a spring minestrone that day. Maybe topped with an arugula pesto or something like that. But since our soup changes every day, I have a hard time keeping up with it. But it's really based on, you know, what is available, what comes in the door, what our farmers brought us from the farmer's market. But I think you may have had a spring vegetable, spring minestrone kind of soup. Does that sound familiar?
Yeah, I think I did that because I wanted to get some of the the farm fresh vegetables in there.
Yeah. And I know you had the pulled pork. Did you have any of the salads?
There was a salad. God knows if I remember what there was a salad. Had to have had a salad because, again, now we're going to the greens. I mean, you got to,
right. You
know, it's like if you're going to do it, you got to taste, when I was in Boston, I went to this Italian restaurant. And I had I did a tasting with the chef, and the chef was bringing all these things out, and I like, not that I've never had it before, the way it was made, et cetera, and I said, "This is Italian." He says, "This is what you would be eating if you were in Italy." And I thought about like the time I was in Italy, and I said, "Oh yeah, I remember they had razor clams, they had this, they had that." So it's the kind of thing, like going into California and you want to eat like you're in California, where you have the fresh, the vegetables and everything from the farms. Yeah, and that's
some loud banging in the background, it is the head coming off of a fish that we're serving tonight. So I apologize.
Oh, that's okay.
We're serving some California coastal caught halibut for dinner tonight. But, that's the thing. I mean, whatever we serve tends to be very local. Some people have called our restaurant hyper-local because we really do source so much from Yolo County. Of course, the seafood is coming in to San Francisco, to the Bay Area, after it's been caught off the coast there. You asked about the potatoes. It was not potato season when you were here. Potatoes should, they're just coming up. And one of our farmers, his father comes to help him do the potatoes. But what we do is we'll source, because you want to have potatoes around, we'll source potatoes from maybe Oregon. And they're, and potatoes are one of those things that's very important to have organic potatoes. They absorb a lot of, I don't know if you've heard of the Dirty Dozen, but there are definitely stone fruit, strawberries, potatoes, celery, a whole list of foods that if you don't eat organic all the time, eating those things organic is very important because they absorb a lot of pesticides and fertilizer.
Really?
And
Wait a second. I'm making a list here. So we're looking at celery, potatoes.
Celery's one of them. It's called the Dirty Dozen. And people could go online and find it. But there are just certain things. Stone fruits. Stone fruit, strawberries. I mean, you just can't wash this stuff off. It just, it's peaches, apples are also, they're the most contaminated things. So if we're going to source something that's not local, we want to make sure it's coming at least organic, because our farmers locally are organic farmers. So you're getting organic food, you're getting local food. But if we're going to source something outside of the county, so your potatoes came from Oregon, and they were organic potatoes.
So when you're saying source, I mean, now for me, I don't really care whether I crave it or not. I look on the package. If it says, if it's not coming from the United States, I won't eat it.
Yes.
I mean, nothing personal against the other countries, but I don't know what the regulations are.
Right.
Well, and I don't know whether they care.
Yeah, and here's an example. On the list of the 12 most contaminated, the Dirty Dozen, grapes that are imported. And think how many people just give grapes to their little kids as a snack, and they think they're giving their kids these healthy things, and these kids are sucking down grapes. I know I always love to eat grapes, green grapes, purple grapes, but they're on the Dirty Dozen list as well. So imported grapes are, not domestic grapes, because, like you said, the laws here restrict the use of, you know, heavily toxic things. Not that organic grapes wouldn't probably be even better.
Okay, so for instance, like I went to Impossible Acres.
Oh, yeah.
And as a matter of fact, they're going to be on the air soon, too, to talk about,
wonderful,
you know, the opportunity to go to a farm and pick your own.
Yes.
Pick your own stuff. And, you know, as I joke about, they, what would happen if they had a nose farm, N-O-S-E? Would you pick your own?
That's good. Yeah, they're a neat place out there to be able to go and pick stuff. And
yeah,
possibly your nose as well.
Yeah, right. But, well, no, that's great to know about with the Dirty Dozen thing. I'm going to, I will, like, you know, kind of go online and check all these things out. But as I said, I'm, you know, even now when I go out to Long Island, it doesn't have to be an organic farm that I go to, but I'm sure that the regulations will allow things that won't be so bad. But there's also like because if you have they were talking about if you have non-organic if it's like an orange. Because you're not eating the peel, you never get to eat
exactly.
The peel, really.
Exactly.
And that's you know, that's
yeah.
Not as
citrus is amongst the least contaminated for exactly that reason.
Yeah, and when you say
something with a peel, like you said, bananas are not heavily contaminated.
Right.
Definitely certain things that are not, but you know, and like your point is well taken about local as well. I mean, for us, local is the most important thing. Organic is the second most important. However, most of our local farmers are organic anyway, so we kind of have the best of both worlds.
Yeah.
And, of course, we have some folks who we purchase things from who are very small farms, and they farm organically, but they're not certified organic because
right.
The cost is too prohibitive.
And
you know,
yeah,
this
I've heard
whole idea,
about that. Yeah.
Yeah, and this whole idea that farmers are out there dousing things with chemicals, I mean, any farmer who is not some big, huge, mega commercial farm, they don't have the money to purchase and douse things with. You know, they prefer to use as little as possible just for reasons of frugality alone. So,
yeah.
You know, it's like, we have this small local farm, and they, like I said, they're these great young people, and one's getting his degree in agriculture, and they have kind of a cooperative going out there, and like I said, they grow organically, but they're not certified. So we don't say, oh, we're not going to buy your stuff because it's not certified.
Right.
What's important
yeah.
to us is, see, and we know these people. It's kind of like what you said. You go to these farms, you get to know these farmers, you know their practices. So local is really the key because you can find out how do you farm? What are your practices? What are you, putting on this food?
Well, I quickly want to just get to that particular dessert that I had.
Pâte à crème.
Describe that for everybody.
The chocolate pâte à crème. You know, it's something we work with our servers on how to describe it as well. There's, of course, mousse, chocolate mousse. Most people are familiar with chocolate mousse. It's whipped and it's kind of airy and light. And then there's, you think of a creme brulee, which is more of a custard. A pâte à crème is very similar in texture and consistency, do you think, you've probably had plenty of creme brulees as well. It has a similar texture. You know, it's a custard, but it's very...
Yeah, it's like... Kind of close to almost if you're having a chocolate pudding, a pudding.
Yeah, exactly. Really kind of silky, creamy.
Silky, rich chocolate pudding.
Yes, yes, exactly. Something that Bill Cosby would approve of.
Chocolate pudding to die for.
Yeah, so we love pâte à crème here. We also, you know, we'll switch it out for... Julia Child has a fabulous, you know, in the Art of French Cooking, she has a great mousse recipe, which we call it, you know, we give her her due. We say Julia Child chocolate mousse. And, of course, she says to add, you can add liqueur to it. And she says you can either add Grand Marnier or Meyer's Dark Rum. And, of course, the Meyer's Dark Rum, oh, my goodness, in this chocolate mousse. But, yeah, we always have to have some chocolate, something on the dessert menu, because there are some people, and you may be one of these people, like my best friend, who says, if it's not chocolate, it's not dessert. So we always have something chocolate, and pot au creme is a regular appearance on our dessert menu.
Oh, that's so good. I'm so glad. And your website is what,
Monticello Cuisine.com.
Oh, cuisine,
Bistro. Yeah, Monticello Bistro was our restaurant in Winners. When we moved to Davis, we dropped the bistro because there's a Thai bistro and there's a Bistro 33, and we just didn't want anybody to say, meet me at the bistro, and get confused. So we just went with Monticello, and the moniker, I guess, is Monticello Seasonal Cuisine. But we want people just to be able to say Monticello. And the website is MonticelloCuisine.com.
Okay. You got it. And then everybody can go on and drool.
Yes. And, of course, if folks are coming to Davis, which a lot of people to Davis for many, many reasons, we would love to have them come and visit us and tell them that they – you know, met us through you.
Well, I'm certainly going to promote Davis. I really enjoyed going there. I mean, you know, actually what happened is, like, I kind of decided, okay, I want to go to California, and I take a deep breath and go, okay, where haven't I gone yet? You know, am I going to be bored? And I, for some reason or other, I just started looking at some places, and I said, wow, here's another area I've never been to. Time to go there.
Well, you don't seem like a person who would be easily bored. I think you could probably have a good time just about anywhere, but it was really fun to have you.
And it was fun being here. I thank you so much for talking with us. Impossible Ache is waiting for me to make a phone call. I'm promising everybody I'm calling them now. And I said, okay.
All right,
yes,
wonderful.
Doesn't mind me.
Well, tell our friends at Impossible Acres we said hello. And, of course, we don't have much time to go pick ourselves. But we certainly know who they are, and they're wonderful out there. And we actually had an employee who worked at their petting zoo. They have a place called Grandpa's Barn, and she absolutely loved it. So a lot of fun things to do in Yolo County.
Okay, cool. Yeah, I still have a lot of writing to do. This is just the radio portion.
Right.
So, okay, I'll probably be in touch with you in case I need any more info for the articles that I write. Yeah.
Perfect.
Okay?
And I will I'll connect you with my daughter Lisa, who's there in New York City. Maybe you two can get together as well.
Sure.
All right.
By all means.
Bye, Merle.
Okay, bye. Have a good evening.
Thanks. You too.
Well, that was really cool. And so, let's see now. They're waiting for me to call. Let's see. I'm so glad that I got this thing here. Let's see. No, let's try this again. Can't do dashes. No dashes in this. Okie dokies. And let's see. California, Kelly. That's what it says.
Hello, Impossible Acres. This is Katie.
Hi, Katie. It's Merle Exit calling.
Oh, hello. How are you doing?
Oh, just absolutely fine. It's time for you to talk to my audience here.
Oh, well, thank you. Thank you for calling up, and thank you for your visit when you came out a while ago. That was really fun. I had a good time.
By the way, just got a hello from Monticello Cuisine, Monticello Bistro.
Oh, yeah, that's that restaurant that just opened up by the Davis Food Co-op. That's a nice place.
Yeah, she wanted me to make sure I said hello.
Oh, well, thank you.
Well, what I want to get to talk about, I was mentioning, like, in the preview of the show, that this is one of the places where you can go and pick, you know, what's growing, or what's ripe. But then again, I think there are things that people pick and they say, oh, I don't want it while it's ripe. But what I want to get into is, but the first thing is, why is this, you know, how did this all come about called Impossible Acres? How did this come about anyway?
Oh, well, the whole thing came about. My husband and I were working, getting our graduate degrees, and we were working in St. Louis, Missouri. And we decided that we really didn't want to go into the whole education postdoctoral stuff very much. We decided we wanted to work together because we liked each other. So instead of him going off to work every day and me going off to a different job every day, we decided that we would do something completely out of the ordinary, and we've always wanted to do a little farm like this. So we decided that it was what God wanted us to do. So we left St. Louis, Missouri, and we came out here, and we lived in my sister's sharecropper cabin, and we began farming her 40 acres. And because of the location of the land, being relatively close to the city of Davis, we decided it was an ideal place for a U-pick, a pick-your-own place. Because if you want to have a U-pick-type farm, you need to be near an urban center so people can get out to your place. If you're way out in the sticks, nobody can make it out there, and they don't come so much. So you have to farm on the urban edge, as they call it in ag. My background is ag. I grew up with my father farmed, my mother farmed, my grandparents farmed on both sides in the Central Valley of California. So I had some experience mostly with vines and trees. And my husband grew up in New York, actually, in Rhinebeck, on a dairy farm. So both of us kind of had it in our background. And we thought, you know, this would be a fun thing. We're going to come out and we're going to just see what happens. We're going to make this U-pick thing. We're going to give it a shot and see what comes of it all. That was about 18 years ago, something like that.
Well, so you've been operating for 18 years, huh?
Well, yeah, sort of like off and on. For the first two or three years, my husband supported us by playing the piano, actually, while we got stuff going. And then we picked up a little bit, and he had to quit playing the piano and start farming with me. And we had the two little kids. And now they're up out of the house in college. But well, when we started, we had two little kids, and we're going with them. They helped us plant the stuff and things of that nature.
Now, when you're when you're planting, I mean, you have to like you know enough like okay, what's in season now? When do you have to plant it? I mean, you have to learn that beforehand, right?
Yeah, the way we've done it out here is we started with things I knew a little bit about. So we started with crops that you just plant them in the winter, and then they produce consistently for the next, 15, 20 years. So we started with trees and berry bushes and stuff like that. We didn't really start with the vegetable crops. The pumpkins were the only vegetable crop that we really did. But now we're just getting into more vegetables. So what we did was we decided we'd start with trees, and we planted them in the winter time. And we started with our apple orchards, did them first, and then we moved on to the peaches and the cherries and the berries and got them all kind of up and going.
Well, the berries are more, I guess, bushes, right? As opposed
yeah,
to...
Yeah, the berries have sort of a funny growth habit on them. There's a bunch of different sorts of bush berries. And by bush berries, I mean raspberries and blackberries, and there's O'Lolly berries and early Marion berries, and there's things called Marion berries, and then there's a bunch of different types of those berries. But they have a rather odd growth habit in that they have the roots that live all the time in the ground, And then every year, the canes grow up really long, like a grapevine. And you then once those canes have grown really long, you put them on a trellis. And then the next year, they produce a little short sprig that shoots out, and then that one makes the berry on that sprig. And then once that one's made the berry, the whole cane is dead, and you cut it out. And then in the meantime, the plant is shooting up from its roots another cane for the year after, for the berries for the year after. So they're sort of like a perennial bush. They just keep going and going.
Well, let me also ask you, so people understand, because I know I never heard of, like, marionberries. There seems to be, like, berries that in, like, what they said they were sort of, like, in the blackberry family.
Oh, well, kind of what happened out in California is that there was a native California blackberry way back, I think it was, like, in the 1920s. And that one, unfortunately, you couldn't breed it because couldn't cross-pollinate it. So nobody could produce any other kind of berry from it. It would just grow wild, and it was not a very manageable thing. It had big old thorns and grew really, really crazy. So then people began to cross it. Some guy discovered how to cross it, and he crossed it with a raspberry first and got this thing called a tayberry. It was the very first cross they made. And then out of that thing, they got the boysenberry, and the boysenberry was the beginning of it all. So some people are very familiar with this, with the boysenberry, and from the boysenberry, you could make all these other crosses. So everything else pretty much comes from the boysenberry in California. Now, they have also the marionberries are ones that are really popular up in Washington because they prefer more rainy weather and a cooler climate. So in different parts of California and in different parts of the West Coast and across different parts of the U.S., there's different sorts of brambles that grow better. And from that original boysenberry, this thing has proliferated, and there are hundreds of types of berries now, all with slightly different flavors and all with decided aficionados and followings of each of these types of berries.
Well, one thing I want to ask you about in terms of, and particularly berries, and what makes the sweetness of a berry? And the reason I'm asking this kind of thing is, and how do you know? How do you know when a berry is sweet to be picking versus, it's like Driscoll puts out raspberries. I have never tasted a Driscoll raspberry that was very sweet. And then I found out why they're not sweet.
Yeah, there's reasons for that. And basically, if you're going to grow a berry and you need to ship it somewhere, then you have to grow a particular variety of berry and you have to pick it at a particular level of ripeness. So if you're going to grow a commercial berry where you pick it and then you ship it to a grocery store, you have to grow a certain type of berry that's very firm, and so it holds up well because otherwise it jiggles on the truck on the way over and it sort of smashes itself. And you also have to pick it a little on the green side in order for it to survive the whole shipping process. So by the time you encounter those two things, you can't select a type of berry or a ripeness of berry that's going to be the most sweet or have the most flavor because you've got to get it to people. And you can't get it to people if you're shipping one that's really sweet and very ripe. It just won't make it to the people.
So that's why, in other words, the advantage of going to a farm where you can pick your own is that you can get things that have just ripened, say, oh, I want to have all this. I'm having a party tomorrow. I want to have all these wonderful berries and whatever, and I want them, really sweet, that you can get that.
Exactly. That's exactly right. And that's why a lot of people come here to pick their own berries, is because if you were to come out here and pick the berry, you can pick them at this beautiful stage of ripeness, and you can actually sample them while you're in the field and know which stage of ripeness you like the best, because some people like them a little sour. They're going to make jams or something with them. And then you can pick them like that, and you can take them back to your house, and you can just serve them that night. And there's nothing that beats the taste of fresh-picked fruits or vegetables. It's just, hands down, beats the ones that have to be shipped and stored.
Oh, yeah, that's for sure. But let me ask you something. Let's just say that I get these, these berries and they're really sweet, ripe. Can I do something like, I don't even know, can you freeze them and then eat them? In other words, oh, my God, I don't want them. I would like to be able to have them in 3 days from now and still be fresh. Can you do that?
Yes.
Can you freeze them?
Yeah, there's lots of things you can do with them. And actually for us out here, our berries keep really, really well. And one of the reasons they keep really well is when you were out here, if you remember, we have them up on this trellis wire. And when they're on the wire, there's not much foliage around between the berry and the air. And that's very important because the air can blow past and dry off the berry. So you don't get a lot of moisture sitting on your berry.
Right.
And that will keep them from spoiling, because they dry really quickly, especially in Davis, where the air is very, very dry. If you go over where they grow a lot of Driscoll berries and things like that, they're dealing with a climate that's more ideal for growing berries because it's moist and it's cool. But unfortunately, those are also the conditions that are really good for producing things that make berries spoil. So we don't get the yields here. We don't get as many berries per plant here as they get in other places, but ours keep really well. So what you do if you want to pick a berry and you want it to keep for a while, the main thing to do is not to wash it. As soon as you wash a berry, you get moisture on it and you remove what's called the bloom from the fruit. And that bloom is sort of like a plant's own self-protection against invasion by spoilage or microbes that would spoil things. So you don't want to wash the fruit until just before you eat it. Then it will last a long time. And our berries here will probably last in the fridge easy 2 weeks, whereas ones you ship won't last.
Oh.
But if you take them, if you want to keep them longer than that, then what you do, you can freeze them, and they freeze really nicely. And then they retain the flavor really well, and then you can eat them either frozen straight out. We put ours in smoothies, which we absolutely love. And then you just take a frozen berry, a quart of frozen berries, and you dump them in the blender, and you put some soy milk in there, and you put in, we use white peach puree from our peaches, and we throw it in with the berries, and that, you just grind it up, and it's really wonderful. You can make it whatever consistency you want, or you can put in orange juice if you don't like soy milk, or regular milk if you don't like either of those things. And it comes out really good.
What I would do, I would then go find the farm that has the fresh milk.
Oh, that's a good idea, yeah.
You know, it's funny because that was one of the things I have thought about. I'm a milk lover,
uh-huh.
and the problem with the fact that I like milk so much is I'm very sensitive to the taste. Now, I had gone to the grocery store. I bought a quart of milk, and it's like not even a day or two later, like it didn't taste right, and it's like. Well, by the time, and I have to look at it, by the time you start from the point of when the cow gave the milk and by the time I have it in my house, all the time that's passed. So the freshness, I mean, I guess, you know, and I have a feeling that I don't think they put them on the shelves in the, you know, refrigerator compartment, you know, at the correct time or whatever. But the thing is that I enjoy, you know, the fresh milk when it's fresh, that would have been really, I mean, that would be really great.
Yeah,
that would be really neat.
One of the really neat things is if you can get raw milk, because it tastes so much different. It tastes so much better than the regular milk, but you can't get them because then it's really hard with all the food safety issues to actually get them.
Well, I was going to say that I went on a farm and I was able to taste it just to see what it tasted like. But what I understand is that then there's a whole difference between getting, like if you get it, as long like if it's pasteurized but not homogenized, you don't have to have it homogenized.
Uh-huh.
You have to have it pasteurized.
Okay.
So when it's not homogenized, I mean, you really, you know, then you get the cream at the top and the... And the whole bit. Anyway, let's get away from that, from the milk stuff, because it's making me thirsty. So what else do you grow? I also wanted to comment on Rainier cherries, which actually I never connected with California. It seems to be something that comes from the state of Washington, Rainier cherries.
Oh.
So I was very surprised.
Okay, the reason you don't associate it with California is because in California, there's not a whole lot of Rainiers that are packed out of California. The reason is the Rainier cherry is a very good pollinizer for the Bings and the Bing types. So in cherries, you need a boy cherry that's a different type than the girl cherry. So if you've got a Bing cherry tree, it needs the pollen from the Rainier in order to set the Bing cherry.
Okay.
It's a Bing cherry. So you have the Rainiers in California that are used a lot for pollinators for the Bings because the Bing is a better cherry in California. The reason most of the Rainiers come from Washington is because the Rainiers in California can't hold their firmness very much. They tend to get soft in the heat, and California has a lot of heat. Washington doesn't. So mostly Washington will ship Rainiers, and California doesn't really ship that many Rainiers. It ships more of the Bing type because they're a little bit firmer, and so they have a better quality. And California will come in before the Washington market. So California has a little niche in there, can sneak in and get cherries before they're ready in Washington because of the heat.
Ah, that's it. Because I think people don't at your farm don't pick it because it doesn't look like it's ripe.
Yeah, at our farm it's different.
Sneaky.
They don't pick the Rainiers because they're a blonde cherry. And people say, that one can't be ripe, so they don't pick it.
More for me. That's what I went. Oh, good, more for me.
but our farm's a little bit different. It's not that kind of commercial farm, you know.
Yeah. So just to give everybody an idea, what do you got growing like right now?
Well, right now, people can come out and pick, and they are picking boysenberries, early marionberries, raspberries. We just started our early blackberries, true marionberries. We've got apriums that are on right now. Apricots are still about 2 weeks out. We've got white and yellow flesh peaches and white and yellow nectarines right now, and that's pretty much it, I think. Well, our strawberries are just finished, so we don't have any more strawberries here.
Okay, and what will then be like the next crop, or the next thing that would be coming out then?
Well, the peaches are just getting warmed up because peaches are really a warm weather fruit, and they taste the sweetest and they taste the best. They like this hot that's coming on to us in California. It makes them really happy, and it makes them really very sweet to have the heat. Some of the crops will shut down in the heat, and they won't make as much sugars, but peaches really like it. So our berry season will sort of fade out because they're more a spring season, and the peach season will kind of ramp up. And then as the peach season's fading out, the apple season kind of comes in. So it sort of works that way. Or the pumpkins come in, you know, just after the apples, or right around that time, too.
Now, also, like if somebody doesn't want to go through the picking, you do sell the products.
Yeah, and what we usually do is we have a roadside stand. We call it Grandpa's Barn. And down at Grandpa's Barn, we have the stuff that's already picked, but we don't open that place until we have enough back here at the picking patch that we can pick it ourselves and sell it down there. So the picking patch always opens earlier, and people will come out here and they can go through the fields and find what they want, but it would take us too long initially to pick them and sell them ourselves. We'd have to charge too much money for them because it takes so long to pick them. When we get in full season, then we pick and we sell out of Grandpa's Barn.
You know, it's funny. I came home. It's like you were selling the cherries. It was like you pick your own. It was $1.99 a pound. I just went to, when I was at the supermarket, the same Bing cherries, $3.99 a pound. And I thought, man, I should have taken more home.
Yeah, but see, you had to do all the work out here. That's one of the reasons.
Yeah,
why
but
not
still,
around.
It's not like, it's not laborious kind of thing. I mean, unless you're, bending a lot or whatever. But it's not just going to a tree, you pick it, you put it in a bag. It's not like, and it could be fun. Kids are there.
Yeah.
You know, especially you bring the kids and you make it a game. Let's see how many you can pick. You know, with the child labor, you don't have to think about it. You can get away with it. You know? And then they say, okay, you get this amount, and Mommy gets this amount because, she earns the money.
Uh-huh. There you go. And
that's one of
the draws of our place that makes it fun is that everything's very family-friendly. So all the trees are short. We keep them pruned short, and we bend them down, and the berry bushes are short. So we don't do anything that you have to do any ladders for. So the kids, and the kids are perfect height for some of the little low, they like the strawberries and the raspberries where it's kind of low bushy stuff. And they're good height for that. And on the cherries, you know, the tall dad can pick the cherries and the short little kids can pick the ones that are hanging down. And it works pretty well like that.
So yeah.
We set the place up.
It's so true.
We set the place up so that so it's kind of a family-friendly place, and it's easy to come out and sort of see what's out there, and it's kind of set up with a central hub at where our little stand is in the parking lot, and from there we make the fields relatively small, and so people can find their way from the cherries to the apricots or over to the different types of berries without too much hiking and have to go too far afield to get a different type of crop.
Yeah. I also wanted to comment on the teenager. I don't know if he was a teenager yet, who found $40.
Oh, that was a little boy. Yeah, I think he was about 10.
Oh, yeah, that's kind of ish, almost
yeah.
Teenager. And he instead of stuffing it in pocket, he, you know, went up to he came up to you and said, "I found this money. Somebody must have dropped it."
Yeah, and that was so neat because we took it back in, and I told my husband about it, and he says, "Oh, yeah, the person who was working the stand yesterday said that someone said she lost $40, and that person paid by a check." So my husband went through all the checks we had got the day before, and he found the one who he thought was most likely to be this lady, and he called her up, and it was her, and she came out and got her $40 back. So that's the kind of thing that happens out here in Davis and with this sort of community that goes on out here. The people in Davis are really, really nice people. They really try to train their kids well and try to, you know, help everybody kind of achieve this generous sort of spirit. That little boy was so nice to have done that, but it's not that unique for what happens in this town. It's really a nice place to live.
I'm moving out there.
Well, you're welcome. You can live in our sharecropper's cabin.
I also wanted to comment on there are things that you make, jams, jellies, or something.
Oh, yeah. We're just getting that going a little bit. We made some jams out here for people, and right now we've had some difficulties getting through government regulations because we're sort of the first people in the county to do a lot of the stuff that we're doing, so there's not anything really set up. So it's been a lot of hurdles to jump through. But this October, we're going to be squeezing cider for the first time, which will be really fun. And we've got a cider press sort of halfway set up now, and it'll be set up by the time the apples come in. And then from there, we'll be also selling smoothies from there and hopefully shortcake, because we got this bang-up good shortcake recipe that uses our berries, so we can have strawberry shortcake or marionberry shortcake or things like that.
Oh, my goodness.
Yeah, so that's hopefully we'll have that up and running by October this year when we do the pumpkins. But yeah, there's a lot of really fun things that you could do when you have a farm that's all local like this. There's a lot of really fun offshoots that you could do to a local farm like this, like the whole thing about value-added products. That's the buzzword in the industry. Value-added means you take your product and you do something else to it, like squeeze it into cider or make it into jam or something like that.
Yeah, that's really great. And by the way, you got a website, I guess, right?
Oh, yeah, we do. It's at www.impossibleacres.com.
Well, that's easy to remember.
Yeah, so people can go there and then see what's right at a particular time, because it's really difficult to call when a particular crop is going to come in. And if somebody really
sure.
wants a particular kind of peach, you know, then you never know what week it's going to be ready, so they have to check the website and see, oh, yeah, there's the Albertas coming in. They're the ones I want. Then they'll come out and get that kind of peach.
Yeah, so far, and the best peaches I've ever had were actually in Colorado.
Oh.
And it was very weird because they, you know, they talk about how great the peaches are, and I went out, you know, onto the pick some peaches, and they were really like unbelievably sweet, and they even said that they get calls from Georgia. asking for their peaches because they're sweet.
But I guess
you know, it's a matter of it. I mean, it's a peach farm.
Okay.
So I guess if they, you know, I guess when you're dealing maybe like with one crop and you can keep going on and perfecting it to get exactly what you want over the years, you know, it may come to that. And of course, having the right weather and so on and so forth, you know.
Yeah. Did you go out and pick that peach yourself in Colorado?
Yes, I did.
See, that is why the peach is good, because peaches are the fruit that suffers the most from having to be picked green and shipped. Because when you pick, you can't ship a ripe peach. They won't make it. And the peaches get a lot of sugars from hanging on there and getting all the photosynthesis from those leaves late in their life. But then by the time they get all the sugars, you can't ship them. So peaches have to be picked green in order to get them to the market without going to mush. And when you pick them green, they don't have the sugar. And peaches are one of the crops that is really, really tastes a whole lot better on you pick than some of the other crops. And that's probably why you went and picked it yourself.
Yes. But they did bring some in, like, for people to taste. And it was just amazing. For me, when it comes to fruit, the whole point in my eating fruit is so I don't have to have chocolate.
Oh.
You know, the sugar from some other means. And I'm not a big dessert eater. I don't want to waste the calories on the cake. You know, just give me the chocolate. Give me a chocolate bar kind of a thing. So the only other thing that I will have that will deal with the craving of sweetness is fruit, but then when I'm eating some fruit and it's not exactly sweet, then either I have to add sugar, which is like, that killed it, you know.
Uh-huh.
So that's why I try as much as possible to, you know, get. And, of course, also when you're dealing, the sweeter the fruit is, the more of a taste of the fruit that you're getting.
Yeah.
At least that's what I'm finding.
Yeah, you get a lot of the other flavors in there that mix in besides the sugar. So you're not just getting a pure sucrose taste. You get a lot of the other things in there. There's a lot of kind of acids and tannins and stuff that are in the fruit that give it its distinct flavor for a particular variety. And those you don't get at all if you just put sugar on your fruit.
Well, I'm going to be going next. I'm calling Hag Farm so we could talk about walnuts.
Oh, yeah.
And so I have to. Everybody's asking me to call them, which is great. That's okay. That's fine. So I'm gonna have to leave you.
Yeah, I'll let you go. Thank you for calling, and I appreciate it.
Sure, and well, I may be in touch anyway because you know I still. This is just the beginning. Before I write the articles. I start off with the radio show, then you'll see this all in the blogs.
Okay.
And if you ever come back
to California, look us up and we'll put you
up
in our showstopper's cabin. Okay.
I'll be back. That's for sure.
And you can bring Eunice with you too.
Oh yeah, they'll both be, and you'll see them in the blogs too.
Okay.
All right, take care and have a great evening.
You too.
Okay, bye.
Bye.
Oh, yeah, it's kind of making me hungry, huh? Well, not hungry, like hungry for, anyway, okay, so now, let's see, okay. Calling Hag Farm to talk with Claire.
Hello?
Claire, it's Merle Exit.
Hi, nice to hear your voice.
You're on the air.
All right.
Now you can introduce yourself. And by the way, I'm calling everybody. I'm calling everybody instead of everybody calling me, which is fine.
Well.
It's great.
Yeah. It's your dime, I guess.
Now, actually, this whole thing, this is because of Blog Talk Radio, and it's set up so that there's no extra charge to call somebody out, to call out to somebody.
Oh, well, that's
fine. Which for me is great because, and it's funny because what had happened is I was like, my first guest was Monticello Bistro.
Uh-huh.
And what happened is I guess she was looking for the number, et cetera, et cetera. And I said, ah, all right. So
Monticello,
I dialed.
Bistro,
she answered the phone.
It
was perfect.
It's Monticello Bistro in Davis?
Yeah.
Oh, that's the new restaurant?
Yeah, that's well. But yeah, because they have it. They're calling it now Monticello Cuisine, so they don't call. They don't want to call it Bistro because they. I think they had Monticello Bistro was in. I think she said in Winters originally.
Oh, I see.
And now they moved. It's only been a couple of years now, and now they're in. Now they're in Davis. The discussion was because they're using all the local products. You know, for their
stuff.
Yes, I
know. The local products are from right around here, right up the road from us. On
yes,
Highway
I think.
16. I know Julie. I know the owner. But anyway, go ahead. Go ahead.
So well, let's get to your place, though.
Okay.
Yeah, you're all nuts, aren't you?
Yes, we are.
So we have a
walnut orchard on 70 acres at the edge of the Capay Valley. We're not really in the valley. We're at the entrance to the valley where Cache Creek comes down and flows towards the Sacramento River, feeds into the Sacramento. So that's where we are, in Esparto.
Esparto,
a little hamlet no one ever heard of. until now.
And it's worth finding.
Oh, it's lovely here. It's a little warm in the summer, but aside from that, it's lovely.
Yeah, it was a little warm while I was there, too. I have to find a time to go to California when it's, like, you know, not cold. It's, you know, springtime, but there's no springtime anywhere. I can't even find springtime in New York City. There isn't.
Oh, well.
Hot, cold, that's it. You know, but anyway, so let's get to the walnuts. Now, first of all, how did you get into this business of why did you decide
on
walnuts?
Accidentally, because we're not in a family that's been involved in agriculture for generations. My husband's an academic, and we were living in San Francisco, and. He decided, after thinking about this, that he wanted to start something that would allow him to still have an income stream, although he was no longer teaching. And so 30 years ago, we after some research about where we wanted to be, we purchased this property. And it wasn't a walnut orchard at that time. It was an almond orchard that was kind of down on its heels. It had been dry land farmed, which means that it had not been irrigated. It was just as the rain fell out of the sky. You dealt with it that way. And anyway, the property looked like it would be a good selection for him to do what he wanted to do. So we got this, and initially we took the trees out and had it laser planed so that irrigation water would flow in the direction that we wanted it to go and wouldn't puddle up. And initially we put in row crops. That was to develop the capital for putting in an orchard, which was our long-term plan. Row crops, you know, it's just what it says. Everything's planted in a row, corn, tomatoes, whatever it happens to be. It's harvested every year. And sold, and so we developed some capital to put in the trees. Trees are not labor intensive, but they are capital intensive because you plant your property, and then you have to wait 7 years before you have something that's worth investing in harvesting. So you have to. There's some time there. There's some planning and some time that's involved, which was fine with us because he was still teaching, and in San Francisco, and we would come up on the weekends or come up in the summer, and we had someone looking out for the property while we were in the city, but we weren't here full time, and we didn't live here. So that's how we got involved in this. After he retired from the University of San Francisco, then we built a house and we moved in. We still go back to San Francisco periodically because you know that's where my heart is, as they say in the song.
Yeah, right. Yeah. Now, so people understand, like, how is there any way to tell, like, you're walking along and you go, oh, there's a farm over there. I wonder what they're growing. Is there some way that you could tell that they're walnuts? What are they
Sure.
Like,
you have to know what
like?
A walnut. If you know what various trees look like, then you can recognize a walnut tree and or an almond tree or a plum tree or an orange tree or whatever. All those things grow around here and are produced commercially so that the trees are in a manageable set of acres. It's not just a handful of trees put up as landscaping. I mean, that's attractive to the eye, but you can't live off that kind of thing. Something that's
right.
just something around your house and makes it look pretty. You can tell if someone points out to you in any particular month of the year what it is that's growing here. And like, it's the same as if you're going down the highway and you see 100 acres of corn. Well, you know what 100 acres of corn looks like. You may not be able to spot the variety, but you
right.
know what corn
yeah.
looks like, and you know what soybeans look like. You know what cotton looks like. You know what these is. It's the same with trees. Once someone tells you, "Oh, that's a walnut tree," then you recognize it no matter where you are. It's like anything else. You know, once someone tells you, then you know what it is. Yeah.
But the thing is, what happens is that when you're seeing it, something like this, when you're seeing this thing growing,
mm-hmm.
you're looking at it, and because you don't see the inside.
I see what you mean. Well, depending on what time of the year it is, the walnuts may or may not be visible to the eye. The walnut trees are deciduous. All the leaves fall off in November and December. They hang on quite a while. It can be fairly cold, and the leaves are still on there. But by Christmas time, the leaves are gone, and the trees are bare, and all you see is the skeleton of the tree, and you see the shape of all those branches, and you see the color of the bark. The color of the bark is kind of a greenish-silver color. When the sun is on it, it's gorgeous. Actually, I almost prefer the trees with no leaves. They're beautiful. And so it's that way until March. In March, there's beginning kind of takes a different color. This silvery color kind of is blurred, and the first leaves will show up. And it's not really warm at all. But beginning of March, you'll have quite a few leaves on there. And then if you have a period of time when it's not pouring rain, and it doesn't pour, generally speaking, in our part of California, the leaves will flesh out very quickly. And the leaves are large. By large, I mean the leaflets. The leaflets are probably 6 to 10 inches long. They're big.
Mm.
And but you don't see any blossoms the way fruit trees look. They look all fluffy and pretty and pale pink and all that. It doesn't look like that at all. There are no blossoms like that on a walnut tree. There's a catkin that hangs down, and that's where the fruiting body of the tree is. Hangs down, it's about, the size of your middle finger. If you have large hands, it's 4 to 5 inches hangs down, and it will both create pollen and allow that to blow into the surrounding trees, to the next row of trees, because walnut trees are wind pollinated. You don't have bees going from flower to flower to flower. You have the wind, which is your ally here, transporting the pollen to that part of the tree, which is going to receive that dusting and grow into a walnut. So that's
right.
But it's so tiny. It's so tiny that you practically need a microscope to see what's going on. I mean, you just don't know. And then after this sort of windy period in March, or the beginning of April, if things are slow, those catkins will just sort of dry up and fall to the ground and look, you know, just look like debris. But you don't see any nuts yet. You don't see any nuts until well into, I'd say, the end of April, beginning of May. You see tiny, tiny little swelling at the end of these branches. And it suddenly begins to look about the size of a small olive, that oval shape, and then it'll get bigger, bigger, bigger. It's called sizing up. And in June, they've just about reached their full size. By the middle of June, you'll see what looks like limes growing on these trees. They don't look like the walnuts that you recognize in the store in a little cellophane bag.
Right.
No, they don't look like that at all. But what you're seeing is the outside hull, and the nut is on the inside. And it'll continue to mature inside the hull until the middle of fall. In October, the walnut trees will be ready to harvest. They still look green like limes, but so you have to have a little faith that everything is going properly. You've been irrigating and you've been fertilizing and you've been checking to make sure that pests have not invaded your trees and spoiled your crop and so forth. And when the time is right for harvest, you contract with a harvester. This is what we do. You contract with a harvester. He sends his crew out with their machinery and their experience, and they shake the trees with a mechanical shaker, and all the nuts fall to the ground. And they're swept into a windrow between the rows of trees, and then they're vacuumed up and carried off to a large truck. It's still green on the outside now.
Mm-hmm.
And they're driven to the huller. And the huller will float the nuts in a kind of a water bath to loosen those hulls, because they are at this point a little bit loose, and they may have cracked somewhat by all this tumbling around in the truck and so forth. And they're tumbled through kind of rollers, and that hull falls off, and the nut now looks like what you would recognize, sort of wrinkled and brown, the way they look in the cellophane bag at the store. But they're wet on the outside. And there's also
you're seeing the shell.
Oh, there's a walnut. Yeah, you don't confuse it with peanuts or anything. It looks like a walnut.
No, I'm saying you're seeing the shell of the walnut.
You're seeing
the shell.
that sort of light brown shell.
Yeah.
And then they're heated up in large bins until the moisture is at the appropriate level, so that they can be transported to whoever's going to buy your nuts, to the wholesaler, essentially. The wholesaler then, you've already agreed with the wholesaler that you're going to have X number of tons that are going to arrive at such and such a time. Now, we
right.
have three varieties, and they're harvested separately. There'll be a couple of days between shaking of the different varieties so that they don't get mixed up, because you don't want to be labeling something incorrectly as one variety when actually it's something else. The wholesaler knows the difference. Now, Joe Blow at the store may not know the difference unless he comes from a farming family, but it's dishonest to call it one thing and when it's really something else. So they're labeled on these bins as to what they are, whether they're Tulares or whether they're Howards or whether they're Hartleys or whatever they are.
So the three, the three of the varieties I had, what were they?
They're Chandler.
Which was like, I don't say the lightest?
Chandler. Yeah, it's sort of a paler shell, and it's a variety that's easy to crack, easy to get perfect halves, if you're interested in perfect halves.
Right.
And the other variety we have is Vina, V-I-N-A. It's a darker meat inside, and it has a more intense flavor. And the other variety we have is Tulare, which is the name of one of the counties in California, Tulare County. And they're the largest. They're round, the nut is in the shell is quite round, like a ping pong ball. And it's the largest of the three. There are lots of other varieties, but those are the ones we have.
And do they all taste different?
You have to really taste quite a few to taste the difference. They look different more than taste different.
Right.
Except for the vines that are a little more intense. They have a...
What I had found was that there was the starting from the least intense to the most intense, and it did have... And that's the word, probably intense, in terms of flavor.
That's right. It all depends how you want to eat them. If you just want to eat them out of hand, then you just, it's like, I don't know, it's like chocolate. You know, there's milk chocolate, and then there's bittersweet, and then kind of middle of the road. It's like that. It's all chocolate, but it's a little bit different.
Can people eat raw walnuts? I know there are varieties of nuts that, you know, they sell and it's all raw.
Well, some of these things are ethnic specialties. We get some requests for walnuts that are they're called fresh walnuts. They're not, they haven't been taken to a huller and put in bins that are warmed up. They're less mature, and they are on the inside. That skin that's on the nut meat is not real dark. It's very pale looking, and they're not so crunchy. They're just less mature. But in certain parts of the world, this is the way they like to have their walnuts. And so we'll occasionally get a request for walnuts like that. But we don't. But not very often. I think there's only one or two families that'll send us something saying, do you happen to have, you know, this, that, and the other? And so we'll make allowances and go snag a few for them if this is what they want. But I don't think it's a big American draw. Most of the time, the nuts that we have are used around the time of the holidays. People like to put walnuts in cookies and things that they bake Thanksgiving and Christmas and that sort of thing. And there are people who eat walnuts all year round, and they'll get them shortly after harvest and put them in the freezer. And, you know, April, May, June, they still have walnuts that taste remarkably fresh because they've been in the freezer all a long time. It's easier to do this if they are out of the shell. They don't take so much room, you know. I mean, you don't... how much room do you want to devote to walnuts in the shell? You know, it's bulky, awkward. But anyway, you can do that. You can keep them.
Now, when you if you're making like walnut oil, you're pressing the walnut, correct? I'm just curious. Like when somebody does that, is there still meat? There's meat left, isn't there?
I don't know.
You're pressing the nuts.
There's someone who does that in our, not our immediate neighborhood, but about 20 miles from us. And we've never spoken with him, but his product is available in the store, and we've bought it, and it's fine. We use it in cooking. But we don't do it ourselves. You have to have the equipment for something like that, and you have to have it on a scale that's large enough to make it worthwhile. You know, it's like if you've got one... If you've got one olive tree, you can't make olive oil for your kitchen. Olives, you need tons and tons of olives. Olive oil, you know. I don't know if it's the same deal with walnut oil, so that's a question that would need more research from Claire. I don't know.
Sure.
I don't know what they do.
Now it's just Yeah.
You can make walnut butter. That's delicious. You know, grind it up in the, take your walnuts and put them in a, I would say sort of toast them a little bit in a frying pan for 5 minutes or so, and then put them in a blender or a food processor and chop them up until they're like a paste, and that is absolutely delicious. Very rich. Very rich, but also very good.
Now, you also, on the property, you, what do you call it? To be eco-friendly, to get
eco-friendly, yes. We don't use pesticides.
Well,
we're not an organic operation,
right.
But we do not use pesticides. But what we have is an integrated pest management system. That means we will encourage the use of pests that are friendly towards us, but gobble up the ones that we want to get rid of. There are a couple of pests that walnut trees will have. One of them is the navel orange worm, and the other one is it's some kind of moth. I've forgotten now. I'm drawing a blank. But anyway, there are a couple of them, and they're predatory insects that will gobble up these pests. So that's how we handle the pest problem instead of using pesticide. And it works very well.
Yeah.
Well, we'll have a little bit of, oh, codling moth. That's the other one, codling moth.
Okay.
Codling moth also attacks apples, I think. Yeah, so it's not unique to walnuts. But it is a pest in agriculture all the time. And the real thing that holds us back from being an organic farming operation is that we use fertilizer, which is, created in the lab. UN32 we use, and it's a liquid which is put into our irrigation water, and that's not a natural fertilizer. But anyway, that's what we do. That's what we do, because you have You have to fertilize trees.
If you you go to your website and people can buy the walnuts, get the.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, they can order the walnuts over the website. They can put an order in now, or they can just send a couple of emails and say, tell me about the such and such, and I think I'd like to have it in October, November, whatever. They can put their order in, you know, that way, pay with PayPal, and we'll mail it to them.
Oh, you only do PayPal?
No, we also do checks for people who are nervous about PayPal.
It's like with me and PayPal. It's like I don't even want to bother.
Oh yeah,
PayPal.
I know. It's like
take my
oil and water. Some people think PayPal is the greatest thing since sliced bread, and other people don't like it at all. So they just say, "Do you mind if we pay with a check?" No, that's fine. You know, some people want to give us their credit card. We don't want it. You can't do that. You can't give somebody else your credit card number. You know.
They do that all the time. They do that all the time with credit cards. Did I lose you? Uh-oh. I don't know. It says you're on the air. And I lost you. I don't know why I lost you. Let's do something. Let's call again and see what happened. Okay. Okay. It's nice that I can do this. I just call back again. Let's see what happened. Well, of course, now it's busy. Let's see. Let's do this again. Let's dial out again. Let's see what happens. Let's see. Okay, let's try calling again. Okay, phone's ringing.
Hello?
Hold on, I'm talking, you're not there.
My phone had a little sign on it, said low battery. I think that was it. It said low battery,
okay.
And I am going, so I hung up.
Okay. All right, in that case, let me let you go.
What else do you need from me before my phone dies?
No, I just, just give me the website, that's all.
The website is walnuts.us.
Oh, that's easy enough, just walnuts.us.
Yeah, that's us.
Okay, great. Well, I'll call you if I need information for the articles, okay?
Okay. Okay,
right.
It's good talking to you.
Yeah.
Bye-bye.
Okay, let's see now. We got... this is what... Wait, let's see. Hi. No.
Hello?
Hiya. Oh, okay. I was just hanging up from one and getting there. Oh, goodness gracious. Okay, how are you? This is... Yeah, you're on the air. So, yeah, okay, Russi, introduce yourself.
Are you talking to me?
Yeah, Russi, right?
Yeah, that's right. My name's Rusty Lucchesi, and I'm on the board of directors at the Heidrick Ag History Center in Woodland, California.
Cool. So, I was there. So basically tell us what this their place is, and then we'll go through what's actually there. What is the whole idea of having this?
Well, we are an agricultural museum where we have a collection of old antique farm equipment and old antique trucks. And it was actually founded by my grandfather. It was built in 1997. And he spent his life, he was a farmer his whole life. And as he got older and had some spare time and was handing off the farming duties to his son, and he got old enough to retire, he started collecting antique farm equipment. And as he had collected so much equipment, over 400 pieces, that he wanted to build a museum to store it all in and that the public could see. So that's how they got started. And he was always big on wanting to educate people about farming and where people's food come from. That was a big deal to him.
That's great. Give us an idea, like what when somebody's coming in there, take a tour. What kind of things are they going to see?
We have a pretty unique collection. It's very extensive. It ranges from farming, and it's mostly based geared towards California. The California era, or the history of California farming, which in a lot of ways was some steps behind the history of farming in the rest of the country. So what someone could expect to see is everything from horse-drawn equipment up till equipment that resembles what we have today, which is probably in the 40s or the 50s era type of equipment, some rubber tires and some stuff, tractors that people would recognize more than the older stuff. We also have several one-of-a-kind pieces that were used in, for example, one of the tractors we have was used in World War I. It's the only tractor of its type known to exist, and it was actually shipped to France for the war. Got there too late for the war. The war was over and shipped back to the Los Angeles area to a farmer down there, and that's where my grandfather found it.
Oh, cool. So when you say some things like, it's, you know, rubber tires, like, so what was, before they had rubber tires, what was being used?
Before the rubber tires, they actually had steel wheels with big, they called them grousers, but it would look like a big point on the, going around a tire that would dig into the dirt. It was, I don't know if you're familiar with maybe studded tires, like for the snow or something like that. It was similar to that, but these real big points that were, you know, they called them grousers, which were probably 4 or 5 inches long. Another familiar type of tractor out here where they were actually developed is a track type tractor where the, instead of a wheel, the tractor rolled along on steel tracks. And for the softer ground that we had out here in California, they were much better. They wouldn't sink into the ground as easy, and they wouldn't pack the ground so bad. So they were a much more desirable tractor here in our area.
Now, give us some ideas. I mean, obviously, I was getting that the equipment, you're watching equipment, and not all, you know, the equipment doesn't all do the same type of things. They're all for different kind of things. So, for instance, what were like some for, you know, what were the various pieces of equipment for in terms of crop?
For different crops, the California is a wide variety of, there's different areas that grow a variety of crops. So a lot of the implements that you would see in the museum, most of them were tillage. They call it a tillage type of equipment that was a plow, like a plow for turning over the soil. We also, there's some cultivators in there, which mainly they skim out the weeds. They clean the weeds out of the soil without hurting the crop. We have several harvesters, several grain harvesters, which were for separating. They would go through a field of wheat, cut the wheat, separate the wheat from the trash, and then it would bag the clean wheat in the bags to take to a mill and throw the trash out the back. And then we also have a horse-powered baler, which would be taken to take that trash or straw and make it into bales and use for animal bedding or something like that.
Now, and in terms of the equipment you have, what were you saying, other than the one for, what you said, World War II?
It was World War One, actually.
World War One. What is the next most, if you want to say, the most interesting piece?
Oh, boy. Well, you know, it would be depending on what you are interested in. We have several one of a kind pieces in the museum. One tractor we have is the first diesel tractor ever sold in the United States. It was made by Caterpillar. We have a good example of a collection of best and whole tractors, which merged together to eventually become the Caterpillar Tractor Company. Another pretty interesting piece, one of the stories I like to tell when I give tours, we have another World War One artillery mover, and it's kind of a funny tractor. The engine and the radiator and all the mechanical parts of the tractor have armor around them, but there's no armor around the driver, so kind of one of the jokes my grandpa used to tell a lot was you could see the military style of thinking that a tractor was hard to come by, but any private, you could throw any private on the tractor and let him drive it so the driver wasn't protected.
Oh, goodness. So, so these pieces that you have, you were saying that these are mostly pieces that people use in California.
As far as the part of California, the main thing that was unique to the California area, it would be the harvesting equipment that we have. And what I mean by that is the other areas of the country have the same type of harvesters and stationary threshers and steam engines that we had, but for a long time, California still put the wheat into 100-pound sacks. And we did this longer than most other areas of the country where the wheat, instead of being put into sacks, was being delivered right into a truck, which could then be driven to the granary where the wheat was stored. Our wheat all had to travel a long distance, so they liked the sacks because it was easier at the time with the equipment and the manpower they had to load the sacks onto barges and transport them down to San Francisco and some of the bigger ports that way onto the ships. So we stayed with the sacking process for a long time. Some of the equipment was similar, but the sack was a thing that lasted in California a lot longer than other areas.
Now, also in doing the tour, I mean, it just happened to be the day I was going, but there are a few areas where you can, I guess, not where you can watch, like a TV is kind of set up and you could see, like, I don't know, I guess they were like short movies about?
Yes.
Yeah, and how many of these? It was like three places, I believe?
Yeah, we have some small computer screens where the visitor could go up and select different movies, and it shows some of the actual equipment running in the museum. And then we also have a TV set up where there's several different harvest videos where a person can sit down. We have some benches lined up, and usually there's a video playing on a loop that shows the type, not necessarily the equipment we have there, but the same type of equipment running in some old movies and stuff like that.
Then also abutting this museum is another one with the trucks. What's that all about?
The truck museum was started by a gentleman named A.W. Hayes, and his nickname was Pop. Everybody called him Pop Hayes. And him and my grandfather were actually pretty good friends. And at one point, Pop had approached my grandfather and said, you know, Fred, I need something to do. I'm getting ready to retire, and I don't have a hobby. And my grandfather gave him an old Chevrolet truck, and he said, well, why don't you try restoring this old truck and see how you like that? You're a mechanical guy and know you could do it, so why don't you see if that's something that interests you? And it turned into the large truck museum that you saw. It became a love of Pop Hayes' also. And when my grandfather built the factory museum, he approached the Hayes Museum and said, you know, thought the trucks and tractors would be a good mix because the tractor side shows the agriculture and the food being produced, and the truck side shows how the products were delivered to the market.
But you also have some trucks not just for that type of stuff, right? I mean, there's some cutesy things,
too. The collection grew into, Pop's collection grew into a large, very large truck collection that has everything from very heavy moving trucks to there's a couple of electric type trucks in there from back in the 20s and just all kinds of real interesting one-of-a-kind trucks in that collection also. Several fire trucks, some over-the-road trucks, some real old ones. So it's a very unique collection. There's a lot of different type of trucks they have there.
Well, once you like once you come into the museum, once you like pay how much, I don't even know how much is the ticket.
I believe, caught me off guard, I'm not sure about that, but I believe the admission's $7, I believe.
Okay, so and that takes both museums.
Yes, yeah, that covers both museums. And it's you've been there. It's a large place. There's a lot to see. So you definitely definitely gets your money's worth.
Oh, yeah. Definitely there's a lot to see.
Yeah.
And what I also found interesting is, and somebody can even have their wedding there, too.
Yeah, yeah, we have a courtyard and an event center that are both available to rent. Actually, both we have in the past had events set up in the museum also where people could spread out and enjoy the collections. And it actually makes a really nice backdrop for an event. It's a neat place.
Yeah, you can have it catered and the whole bit.
Yeah, we do catering and are able to provide several. The event director has several chefs on call from around the area that have worked in some of the nicer restaurants, and they turn out some wonderful food. They do a really good job on our event center and catering. It's a really, really well professionally done.
However, it's not like you can have. There's no cafe on the property. You can't, grab something to bite.
Right, there's a small, a few refreshments at the store and stuff, but no, we don't have any,
like you said,
a cafe style, anything like that.
Yeah. Well, you're really there for taking in the interesting, equipment to see. Well, what it's really nice for is like if you're doing a tour in that whole area. I mean, I went to like Impossible Acres to a farm to pick your own. I went to a walnut farm. When you notice, looking around and seeing all these farm areas. To go there and then get a better sense of, how things operated, or you're going even to a restaurant that has the local food, and then you're getting a sense of, what kind of equipment that these things, that it came from. Not now, but and originally how the kind of things that were being used. So, I think it's a pretty cool thing to do. By the way, your last name, is that very common? Okay.
I don't think so, but I've met a few. Most of my family's from the area, but from the Woodland area here. But I've met a few Lucchese's around. But no, I don't think it's overly common.
Oh, okay. The reason I happen to know somebody the man is a sculptor. A famous sculptor named Bruno Lucchese.
Uh-huh.
That's why I was kind of wondering. I'm going, of all last names,
Yeah. I get asked about the Lucchese cowboy boots a lot, but
that's the only other famous one I know.
It's actually spelled a little different, but it's close.
Oh, okay. So, how long have you been doing the tour, by the way?
Actually, I grew up not far from here in Sacramento, and I can remember for as far back as I can remember wanting to run out with my grandfather and learn about the old tractors. He put me on one the first time when I was 4 years old. I was driving around on one of those tractors, and I had a love for it ever since. So I was giving tours before the museum actually opened, when he had all the equipment at his house, and so I've been involved in it probably, you could say, for over 35 years.
So in other words, you've actually, let's say, been on some equipment while it was like going into, on the farm itself, let's say, or doing
Yeah, we
so
would.
You have,
I'm sorry, my grandfather. He loved to see all the equipment run. His big thing was making it all operational. Just practically everything on the tractor side that you saw in that museum will run with some work done to it. But his big thing, he'd like to get an old harvester out or a threshing machine and harvest a little wheat every year. We'd have a little small kind of threshing bee kind of thing at his house.
Did you say he'd harvest a little weed?
Wheat.
Or
no,
wheat.
Sorry. No, no weed at all for us.
Oh, okay.
But, yeah, we would harvest the wheat and put it in the sacks just like they did back in the old days, and that's how they did it when he was growing up and he was learning how to farm. But, I have worked on a lot of that equipment as it worked, like it would have in the old days.
Well, that's great. Well, now, just to get people a sense of where it's located, where is the center located?
The center is located in Woodland, California, and it's approximately 25 miles north of Sacramento on Interstate 5. It's about 10 miles from the airport, from the Sacramento International Airport, and it's a good side trip from Sacramento. If anybody's in the Sacramento area, it's not a far drive to get out there, and it's definitely worth your time. You wouldn't be upset that you drove all the way out there. It's actually not too far from Sacramento.
Cool. And the website? Got a website?
The website is www.aghistory.org.
There's
a lot of information on that.
Cool. All right. Well, Rusty, I appreciate you calling in and telling us about the place. Now, my next step is, of course, to blog about it, write about it, and you'll find the blog very funny. I forgot.
Great. Well, I thank you very much for having me, and I hope I was able to answer all your questions like you wanted.
Oh, sure. Definitely we'll get this place promoted.
Well, I appreciate that very much. That's our biggest challenge is our marketing. You know, we're a nonprofit organization, and any help we can get is very much appreciated.
Yeah, well, wait, I was going to talk to Yolo County and maybe set some kind of a tour, like the, you know, for people to do a type of tour. You go here, 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 and here, you know, kind of a thing to get a sense,
yeah.
You know, go to a restaurant, go to the a farm, you know, things like that, and take all this in to get a, you know, or call it the farming tour of Yolo County, you know.
That'd be great. Yeah,
one package deal kind of thing.
Yeah, definitely.
Okay. Well, have a great evening.
Well, you too, and thank you very much for having me.
You're very welcome. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye. Thank you again.
Yep. Okay. Yeah, that's what I think people can get much of an idea. And now I just have to call my friend and say, come on, you got to take me out to the island. I want all the freshest food around. I'm going to end it a bit, by the way. I'm sorry. Yes. Go ahead. Where's the other one? Yeah, well, they were both with me on the trip, so, you know, they wanted to make sure that they got something in. Next week, I think, hopefully, I'm going to be talking about four of the restaurants that I went to in California, and that I'm going to see if I can get them all to call in, and we'll talk about the various cuisine, and where they get their food, etc. So everybody have a great day, evening, or whatever. This is Merle Exit saying TTFN.